Let's face it, no one's really too sure where the economy's going these days. At the consumer level, we are all dealing with basic stuff like rising food prices and the prospect of $4 gas. People in the head offices of major banks and financial institutions are looking at their own woes. A weak dollar, bad loans, and falling profits are all shaking the confidence of institutions that were once thought to be the unshakable foundation of the economy. We saw the effect of that earlier this year with the near collapse of Bear Stearns. Today, the story turns back for an inside look at what happens when a financial giant stumbles. It was the summer of 1991 when the mighty bond trading firm Salomon Brothers looked like it might be going under. Bob Denham was the man brought in.
There was the immediate worry at the very beginning about whether it was going to be a run on the bank that could cause the firm to fail. Once confidence disappears, even secured financing disappears, which is a lesson that was very clear at Salomon Brothers, but had to be learned again a few weeks ago at Bear Stearns.
Patience, perseverance, and panic. What happens when the boardroom becomes a bunker? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
To get even a glimpse inside the recent bailout of Bear Stearns, it makes sense to look at the near collapse of Salomon Brothers back in the early 90s. Salomon Brothers had a reputation as a hard-charging band of traders who worked the bonds and the mortgage markets of Wall Street with more bravado than any other firm. The first trouble came when a rogue Salomon trader started bidding illegally for government bonds. The real trouble came when the news leaked out that senior executives at the firm were sitting on that news. In very short order, the company was facing criminal indictments and probable bankruptcy. Bob Denham was part of the rescue crew. He came in as general counsel. Much of what he knew about Salomon Brothers came from the book Liar's Poker. It was written by one of the Salomon traders, and it described an almost manic cowboy culture of trading.
I read Liar's Poker when he came out. I was on a ski trip with my family and started reading it after dinner one night and stayed up until I finished it. It was so compellingly written. But, you know, when I got there, it wasn't a cowboy culture. It was a culture of quick decision-making, of calculated risk-taking. And there were some things about the culture that needed changing, and there's some things about the culture that I wanted to see different. But there was also an awful lot about the culture that was really healthy. People were intensely engaged and were extraordinarily proactive. You know, I came in at a good time in a way, terrible time in a lot of other ways, but it was a good time to see the culture at its best because the culture was being threatened and people were rallying together to deal with the threat.
The man leading that rally was the financier Warren Buffett. He owned some $700 million of Salomon stock, and he wasn't about to see it go under. The man that Buffett appointed to oversee the rescue and rebuilding of Salomon Brothers from the legal side was Bob Denham, a trusted lawyer friend from Los Angeles.
Well, it was clearly going to be a big change in my life. Warren called on a Saturday and asked how soon I could start. And I said, well, I've got to transition a few things I'm doing, and I'll do that, and I'll start Wednesday, which is my birthday.
What a birthday present. Do you remember walking into Salomon Brothers in a firm that was in such considerable turmoil? Do you remember that?
I'd gotten to New York late. I didn't get to the apartment, I think, until about 3 or so in the morning, and I didn't get to work probably until about 8:30. The general counsel's office was a nice big office on the 39th floor, but it was sort of away from the action center for dealing with the investigation. And the action center was on the 43rd floor where Warren's office was, where Derek Maughan was. Warren had made Derek president of Salomon Brothers. The head of corporate communications, a guy named Bob Baker, was on 43 as well, and that was a critical role in the event. So I wanted to be up close to where the action was, so I got a small interior office there, and I was pleasantly surprised there were flowers and birthday greetings from a couple of friends. I guess Derek had apparently dropped by my office before I got there and left a note saying, Denham is a player.
Bob Denham had another welcome waiting for him, something that might not be a surprise to most new employees, but a bit unexpected for the man who would eventually be CEO of Salomon Brothers.
The second day I was there, I had to be drug tested. I had two or three notes when I got to work that morning saying, don't eat poppy seed bagels.
Good luck.
And I was I was never sure whether they were giving me that message just to warn me that if you eat a poppy seed bagel, that can cause a false positive because of the opioid link, or whether they were giving that story to me in case I needed an alibi.
I'm wondering what the tone of the 43rd floor was.
People were very worried. Warren had delivered several messages, and people were very focused on those messages. One message was, there's plenty of money to be made in the middle of the court. We don't need to play balls in the chalk.
The translation to that, I assume, Bob, is don't even flirt with the rules, right?
Yeah, if it's near the lines, forget it. I don't want to be having to make calls about balls in the chalk. Another related message was, if you lose money for the firm, I'll be forgiving. If you lose an ounce of reputation, I'll be ruthless. Michael Lewis, in his book about Solomon Brothers.
That's Liar's Poker, right?
Liar's Poker uses the phrase that you need to have a jungle guide. And I had a lot of jungle guides. Very early, Ron Olson and I needed to understand the financing markets for Treasury securities. Fairly complex. It was Friday before Rosh Hashanah. We got together, a group of people, Eric, and sat down in an office just off the trading floor. And for several hours, they did a seminar on how government financing works. And it was getting later in the afternoon on Friday, and they had families that were expecting them at home for Rosh Hashanah, and they were calling saying, I'm going to be a little bit later. I'll be able to leave in 30 more minutes. No, I'll be able to leave in another 30 minutes. But they stayed as long as we had good questions to ask. That was an experience I had time after time those first few months. People going to extraordinary efforts to make sure I got the whole story.
And the simple version of the story was this. Solomon Brothers was on a financial precipice. The government had opened a full criminal investigation into this illegal bond trading, and the wisdom on the street was, if the feds come back with indictments, Solomon Brothers was going under. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Bob Denham says part of his job was to make plans for the possibility of that bankruptcy. Secret plans.
I got together a meeting at bankruptcy counsel. Cravath, Swain & Moore, a lawyer named Fritz Schwartz, was doing a lot of the work on the government issues with us, and Fritz got together a couple of bankruptcy lawyers from his firm at his apartment for dinner in the evening. His wife was away, and we were very secretive about it. Everyone arrived separately. Everyone left separately, sort of in intervals, so that people wouldn't see me going into a meeting with bankruptcy lawyers. And that's why we did it at his apartment up on Riverside Drive instead of in any more public place.
Because that kind of headline in the Wall Street Journal would be all it would have taken, right?
Yeah, I had to avoid the story that we were preparing for bankruptcy, or that would have been self-fulfilling prophecy.
And yet at the same time, Bob Denham says he was still making sure there were no more skeletons that the investigators might discover.
We had to find whatever wrongdoing had occurred, not just be content with the one event that we started out knowing. We had to make sure we'd gotten to the end of the story. So we were running an investigation. We were talking to the government, advising them anytime we learned anything new. But additionally, the circumstances we were in, publicity of government investigation and so forth, combined to produce a lot of other things just coming out of the woodwork. So every day there'd be one or two new things, mostly pretty minor, but you couldn't always tell from the first phone call or the first fax or email you got how minor it was. For example, we had a fax from some anonymous employee in one of our offices in Asia complaining that the manager of that office had given excessive gifts to some government officials.
What would an excessive gift be?
I forget what it was, but it was a suit of clothes or something, or entertainment that was perhaps too lavish. It's a culture in which there was a lot of gift giving.
Right.
We started an investigation of that. I asked a trusted long-term employee, not a lawyer, to go and get a basic understanding of what was going on in that office. He went over there, and I got a fax back saying that the person who had been accused in the anonymous fax, and who was reputed to be a martial arts master, had threatened to pull his heart out and eat it in front of him. thought it'd be wise to get security to accompany him. And I said, you'll get all the security you want. We reported that immediately to the SEC the day we got the note from the employee. Well, the next note we had from the employee included a threat to report this to the SEC. And I said,
don't worry, we've done that already.
we didn't know who it was, so we told everybody in the office, we've already told the SEC, the person we told is so-and-so. If you want to talk to them, that's the person to call.
How did that end?
it ultimately didn't amount to anything of significance. The claims were overblown, and the way we dealt with it, I think, was satisfactory to the government. So it never went anywhere. But it's an example of the way things would come out of the woodwork and temporarily blow up to be the problem of the moment, if not the problem of the day.
As if you didn't have bigger problems you were handling all along. Tell me something, though. How much had the reputation of Solomon Brothers been hurt already? Did you have any sense of that at the time when you went in?
Clients were nervous. Solomon had a very large balance sheet when this began, and Solomon was in the process of bringing that balance sheet down as rapidly as it could so as to take some pressure off of the funding needs. But still, there was a lot of scrambling going on to maintain access to financing. It never reached the crisis stage that it got to at Bear Stearns, but the worry was that it could.
Still, though, Bob, was there a time when you wondered if Solomon Brothers was going to make it through that period, through those first few months when you were trying to work out your affairs with the feds? Because, I mean, it seems to me we've got two things going on. One, Solomon Brothers is trying to square things with the regulators. And on the other hand, Solomon Brothers is trying to survive as an investment bank. Did you ever question whether or not it would survive?
Yeah, there was the immediate worry at the very beginning about whether it was going to be a run on the bank that could cause the firm to fail. Once confidence disappears, even secured financing disappears, which is a lesson that was very clear at Solomon Brothers, but had to be learned again a few weeks ago at Bear Stearns. And beyond that, there was a risk that the firm would get indicted, would get a criminal indictment for the Treasury auction rule violations.
And so they waited. Through the fall of 1991. They waited through the winter and finally into the spring of 92 when word came from the feds about the fate of Solomon Brothers. This 80-year-old investment bank was a pillar of Wall Street. Could it really just go down? It's an interesting question today when we see big firms like Countrywide and Bear Stearns and other institutions in trouble. I'll pick up the story of Solomon Brothers with Bob Denham, the man who was at the center of the action, in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. A few weeks back, Wall Street was rocked with the news of a government-backed bailout for Bear Stearns, one of the largest investment banks in the country. That was about the time when the depth of the subprime loan crisis became clear to all of us. Today, I'm talking with a man who played a key role in the rescue of another Wall Street giant, Solomon Brothers. Back in 91, the investment firm was nearly brought down by the revelation of illegal trading. Warren Buffett, the financier, asked his friend, Bob Denham, to be the lead lawyer at Solomon. Bob remembers that it was tough work. To begin with, they didn't even know how much illegal trading had taken place.
We knew we didn't know the whole story, and yet we were under a lot of pressure to get the story out. We had to strike a balance in our communications so that our message was, we're telling what we know, we're still investigating, and if we learn more, we'll report that. Once we found other instances, we first reported it to the government, and then we announced it to the press.
Didn't you fear every time you made one of those announcements, though, that it was going to be a straw that broke a camel's back, that people were just going to...
Sure.
Yeah.
And you wanted to get it over with as soon as possible. So there was a lot of pressure on doing that investigation quickly. At the same time, you had to do it thoroughly because you didn't want to miss something.
The key point is this. Solomon Brothers was still in business while it was under investigation, and investor confidence is a very fickle thing. So Bob Denham says he spent a lot of time with the company's head of communications, Bob Baker.
The worst thing we could do was to something was so or claim that we were at the end of the story when we weren't. A lot of corporate communications people get tempted to sort of oversell a story.
Mm-hmm.
That could have been fatally dangerous, and Bob never had that temptation. During the first few weeks when I was a few steps away from his office, almost every day around 4 o'clock as reporters were approaching deadlines and calling with their, you know, their questions of the day, the things that they'd picked up and so forth. I'd go to his office and review what he expected the questions would be. And then a lot of times I would listen in to his side of the conversation as he would respond to questions. And if I got nervous about the direction he was going, I'd start giving him hand signals or write him a note and, you know, sort of coach him.
At that point, though, confidence is everything, right? I mean, you're trying to tell the story, but you also want to tell your story, and you want to make sure that people aren't any more unsettled than they already are about the trouble that Solomon Brothers is having.
The most important thing was that the story you're telling is the real story and that the real story is a good story. And, you know, here the real story was that a board of directors, when it first learned of the problem, had very quickly changed house, put in a new team, and there was no doubt about the commitment of the new team to correct anything that was wrong and to make sure that things like this couldn't happen again. You know, the violation didn't occur at the top of the firm. The violation occurred by an important person, the person running the government desk, but it hadn't been approved by the senior management. What the senior management had done, though, was when they found out about it, they hadn't dealt with it promptly. And that was the failure that caused them to need to leave.
Well, that's why that suspicion hung around, right? Are they telling us the truth this time, right? You know?
Right.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Bob Denham had been brought in to manage the legal affairs of Solomon Brothers at the moment when it was in danger of going under. So early on, he's thinking, what have they done? But after time, he starts thinking, what can we do? And the question is, when does an outsider become an insider?
At the very beginning, when there was so much happening, so much to learn, so many critical decisions to make very quickly. And at the end, when we were concerned about, was there going to be an indictment? Were we going to succeed with what we had done? We had done everything we could, but was that going to be enough? And there, because by then I'd been there 6 months, 7 months, 8 months, in a lot of ways, the actions that had been taken that the government was going to make a judgment about in deciding whether we had satisfied them with our actions, satisfied them with the pace of change and the kinds of change that was made. I was by then invested in that, heavily invested in that. So it was going to be a judgment on me. And that raised the stakes a lot. And that was the only period that I had any trouble sleeping. At the beginning, maybe I was so tired and I didn't have long to sleep at night, but I had no trouble getting to sleep. But the last month or so, while we were waiting to hear the government's decision, I'd lie down and I'd lay awake thinking about what else could be done, what the consequences might be if things went bad.
And to try and simplify what you were waiting for a call from the government, and the call was going to tell you, yes, Solomon Brothers is being indicted for these violations, or no, you're not going to be indicted for these violations.
That was the key thing we were waiting for. 99% of what we were waiting for was to know whether we were going to be indicted or not.
And did you know when the call was going to come, or was that a part of the suspense as well?
It was not at all clear, because there were a lot of different pieces of the government involved. They had to coordinate among themselves, and we didn't know how long that was going to take.
This is the Fed and the SEC and Justice. And
the SEC and Justice was really several parts of Justice. The U.S. Attorney's Office in New York, the Antitrust Division at Main Justice in Washington, and then the Civil Division at Main Justice was involved. So there were maybe three parts of the Department of Justice involved. The Treasury was involved, because it was the Treasury's rules that had been broken. We really didn't know what their judgment was going to be. We were dead worried.
An indictment judgment at that point, looking back on it now, Bob, would that have been the end of Solomon Brothers?
Yes, I believe it would have. We would have had to file bankruptcy, and we intended to file bankruptcy promptly upon getting the news of an indictment, because you don't want to wait until there's already been a run on the bank to file bankruptcy. You can manage the run a lot better if you're already
under Chapter 11.
If you're already under Chapter proceedings. So we planned for the worst, and if indictment came, we would be prepared to file bankruptcy.
And so they waited, ready, at a moment's notice, to file for that bankruptcy if that was what was needed.
Every weekend, we would be sure that we knew where at least one federal district judge from the Southern District of New York was going to be on the weekend, so we'd be able to find them and make the filing. If we found out on the weekend that despite our efforts, the firm was going to be indicted for what had happened before we got there.
This is another area where there's a parallel between what you went through 17 years ago and what happened in the case of Bear Stearns, because The Fed has made the argument in recent weeks that it had to act to guarantee Bear Stearns because if that didn't happen, the collapse of the company could have caused much more severe repercussions for the, you know, other firms on Wall Street and beyond that, the economy. In the case of Salomon Brothers, was it just a struggle to save that firm, or did you believe at the time, Bob, that there was more at stake, that it could, in fact, have had broader implications for the national economy?
There would have been systemic impact if Salomon had gone under. Would that impact have taken down other major financial institutions? I don't know, but my read of it, I guess, would be that it probably would not have in that environment. Remember, that environment was an environment of healthy financial markets. And the extent of the interrelatedness of financial institutions has multiplied since 1991-92. The Fed in 2008 was addressing a different problem. In 92, if Salomon had failed, it might have provoked to some extent a financial crisis, but it wouldn't have taken an existing crisis and perhaps pushed it into
– It wasn't a snowball that was already on its way downhill.
It wasn't a snowball that already started rolling, exactly.
It was one morning early in May 1992 when word finally came to the executives at Salomon Brothers. The Feds had finished their investigation. Bob Denham was waiting for the news with Salomon's president, Derek Maughan, and another lawyer, Ron Olson.
Ron and I and Derek, I think, were talking. Derek's assistant came in and said that there was a call for Ron from Otto Obermeier, who was the U.S. attorney for the Southern District. So Ron went out of the room, went over into the conference room, and he looked very nervous. And Derek and I were very nervous. And Ron was gone for about, not long, maybe 5 minutes, most 10. And came back in with a big smile on his face and with his posture relaxed and instead of tense as it had been, and said, "We're not going to be indicted." We then began discussions of the other terms of a resolution and the civil penalties we would pay and so forth. But
no champagne, no celebration when you got that
No,
call.
No, it was, you know, this was, I don't know, 10 or 11 in the morning.
You'd been waiting 9 months for this call.
And we had a lot of things to do. It was time to, you know, we had to get started implementing it. Every day that this took was costing the firm and lost opportunity. It was harder to get people to do business with it. It was harder to hold on to talent. And so that every day you could gain in terms of ending it sooner had substantial economic value.
There must have been a moment, though, when you allowed yourself to celebrate.
The more celebratory time was a week or so later when we signed the agreements. And we signed and announced, and the government announced. And then everything was really over with, and we could feel more like celebrating.
When you look back at that nine-month period, Bob, what kind of effect did it have on you, physically, mentally, what?
I learned an enormous amount. Because I was parachuted in the middle of a crisis, it probably shortened my attention span. I got used to the need to compress problems and deal with things very quickly. So it had the effect of causing me to want to, you know, focus intently on something, deal with it, move to the next thing.
As part of that settlement with the Fed, Salomon Brothers paid a fine that was, at the time, the largest such penalty ever levied, close to $300 million. A month later, Bob Denham was appointed as chief executive officer of Salomon Brothers. The investment bank disappeared when it was acquired by another company in the late 90s. Bob Denham's now back in L.A., practicing law. I'm continuing our look inside the boardrooms with another rescue artist of the business world. Guy Sansone is a senior executive who is specifically brought in to run companies when everything's falling apart. Guy's what you call a chief restructuring officer. Now, it won't be a surprise to learn that these are people who are very busy these days. Guy was once called in when a major healthcare firm, Health South, was adrift in accusations and investigations of fraud. Not a pretty picture.
When we walked in the door, there were already a number of the senior officers who had left the organization. The next wave of senior management either stopped coming to work or in lockdown behind closed doors. And the organization was rudderless and looking for leadership, which we had to immediately provide.
The first day that you walk in, what do you see?
Shock, people looking for direction. We see boards wanting to call in advisors but not knowing who to call. We see lenders wanting to send in their audit groups. We see in healthcare third-party payers screaming for audits, convinced that they're due money back. Every vendor demanding prepayment. We see management either looking for new jobs immediately or looking for cover.
And how do you establish credibility right off the bat? Do you pick out a particular suit on the first day in? Do you take a couple of deep breaths before you walk through the door the first time? I mean, it must be a case, Guy, where you're going to get them right away or you're going to have to really work to get them.
You're going to win them over inside of the first couple days. You have to exude confidence, but at the same point in time, make sure, I think the turnaround crisis manager today needs to be a little more humble than the slash and burn type. I think today you have to come in and be authoritative, you have to be decisive, and you have to listen. There are people in virtually every organization that are going to have answers. You have to want those people with answers to bring them to you.
But I'm curious to know how you do it. I mean, do you do it by the suit that you wear, the tone of your voice? I want to know how you make this work.
There's no question the tone of your voice day one is very different than your tone of your voice day 100. There's no question the way you stand up and present yourself in front of a group is different day one than when you're there 3 or 4 months. You want to present yourself both verbally and non-verbally as a pro who's done this before.
So it's not all bluster and tough guy and I don't want any questions. You're actually trying to get people to trust you. You're trying to bring in a sense of calm?
Absolutely. And say, we're going to be the ones that are facing the pressures from banks, the pressures from auditors, the pressures from governmental agencies. Whatever it happens to be, we're going to bear the brunt of it.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Ours is a program that uses personal experiences to help us all understand what's going on. And in uncertain financial times, this is kind of a peek inside the corner office. Recently, Guy Sansón was brought in to restructure a failing hospital, St. Vincent's in New York City. When he arrived there, he was not immediately welcome.
The management team was very, very skeptical. I was their fourth CEO inside of 4 years. So they wanted to know, what was I going to do differently? And I said to them, I've never actually run a hospital.
See, right away, I'm seeing the doctors going, oh, no. What
exactly.
Have we got?
I purposefully said to them, I don't know a thing about running a hospital, but I've run a crisis. You have to make yourself available to us. I will make myself available to you. We will make all operating decisions, and we're going to make them quickly. In exactly this tone. And what's not going to happen is the status quo, losing $8 million a month.
$8 million a month.
$8 million of cash a month when I walked in the door.
So you become that symbol of change. They need to be able to look to you and say, all right, guy's going to do something. We're not sure what, but you know, we'll give him another day or another day or another day. What about the kinds of symbolic changes you make right out of the gate in terms of doing stuff at the hospital? Do you have a quick list of things that you think will build their trust?
There has to be something symbolic done, which is low cost, to effectively start to change the culture and get the organization to believe that there's a new sheriff in town. At St. Vincent's, you had an organization that had been once the proudest healthcare institution in the city of New York. But in the last 10 years, their losses had mounted to a point where they could no longer pay the contractor who was doing work outside of the building. So that person left his machinery. They did not have the money, or they thought they did not have the money, to replace awnings on the building that had St. Vincent's logo and name on it that welcomed people to the front door, and they had both torn away. And we said, well, that's not going to cost a lot of money. We're going to put the awnings back up, And we're also going to pay this contractor what we owe him. I think it was about $5,000. So he'll move the equipment from right next door in our emergency room. We're going to have to send a message that it's okay to come back to St. Vincent's. It's okay. Our doctors are still strong doctors. We've had some problems in the past, but we will turn the corner.
Why is it that you could send that signal by putting blue awnings over the windows? I'm interested in that.
Because I think the organization and the community viewed that as a symbol of the failures.
Huh.
Said, listen, they can't even afford to replace their awnings. Why would I want to go get taken care of there? Because guess what? Nothing changed inside. Our doctors were still the same doctors.
But did it make a difference? Did it make a difference in the relations that you had inside the hospital or in the way that visitors would respond when they came in? Did you see that?
I think it made a huge difference with the physicians. Patient satisfaction actually went up. And once we got on a path to reorganization, you can see how the symbolism and the community acceptance of St. Vincent's changed. We've recovered a patient base that was going elsewhere.
This is not work for the faint of heart. At one point in his restructuring at St. Vincent's, Guy Sanson decided he had to raise the rent for the nuns. Not a popular thing to do, but corporate rescue jobs aren't popularity contests. More on this in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Today we're looking at the shaky economy and its effect on business. Guy Sanson is a chief restructuring officer, and he's giving us an inside look at what it's like to work with a struggling company. And let's face it, many are struggling these days. In the case of St. Vincent's Hospital in New York City, Guy had to raise the rent. People warned him, don't raise the rent, not for the doctors, not for the nurses.
And by the way, don't raise the rents on the nuns. And again, I had to stand by that first letter that everybody was going, in order for this institution to become what it has to be, everyone's got to share in the pain. And if we put forth the institution ahead of your individual parochial interest, you know, the institution will ultimately survive and thrive, and thus everybody will benefit.
What was it like in the early days? I mean, were there really long days and long nights for you when you're sitting there at 7 o'clock in the evening at your desk going, oh, man, how am I going to make this work?
One of the co-founders of the firm used to tell me a story when he was running a large retailer. He used to have to get on every week and talk to his employees, and they had this video system that allowed his message to be transmitted into every store. He used to get up in front of the group and tell them exactly what he was doing and how they were going to get through this and everything was going to be okay. And he said as soon as the message, you know, ended, he turned off the recording and turned to one of his partners and say, I have no idea how I'm going to do this. are we kidding ourselves? There's always moments of doubt. You can't let the organization see you question yourself or feel that you're not going to be able to lead them through it.
You were there for just shy of 2 years. I'm wondering, when you come in and when you do that kind of turnaround work, is it hard for you to leave?
Very hard to leave. You leave your friends, you leave your family, and parachute into some other community, some other organization. Today, I've got friends in Fairfield, Iowa, and Sparks, Maryland, and Orlando, Florida, Birmingham, Alabama. And it's those relationships and bonds that are created with a management team that's gone through a crisis and a restructuring together that I don't believe get broken.
But, I mean, I know a number of people who do the kind of work that you do, Guy, wind up being courted to stay at whatever organization they've turned around because they say, oh, we finally got someone who knows how to run this place. Let's figure out what it's going to cost to keep him, pay him that, and he'll be our permanent CEO. Are you ever tempted when you go in to do this kind of work to say, this is fun. Now I got this place running. I'm going to stick around for a while.
It's very tempting, but I personally know the organization will be better off with someone else.
St. Vincent's Hospital in New York is currently raising money for the most dramatic change that Guy Sanson recommended. They're planning to move the entire hospital across the street. If you have your own suggestions for the kind of inside business stories that help us all understand what's happening in the economy today, tell me the story. Go to our website. You can find me at thestory.org. You can just leave me a couple of notes there. Our last story today brings me back to an issue where I've had a number of conversations. You may have heard earlier when I've talked with several of the lawyers who represent the men being held at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. I find it's one of the best ways to discover what life is like for those detainees and to explore just how complicated the legal maze has become. Well, this next story also involves one of those lawyers, but it's more a story about him than his client. Bob Ginsburg is a lawyer for Abdul Zahir. Now, the two of them met face-to-face for the first time about a year and a half ago.
Basically, the first question that he asked me was, who are you and why are you doing this? It was really fascinating. It turned into a lecture by me to him on the American legal system, the theory that everybody is entitled to representation. I spent 2.5 hours parsing the United States Constitution for him so that he could have an understanding of what my role was and why I was representing him. And he now understands fully that I'm committed to trying to get him some kind of a hearing somewhere, so that he can challenge his detention.
Although Abdul Zahir was originally charged with taking part in a grenade attack that injured a Western journalist, that charge is apparently no longer hanging over him, and yet he remains locked up, now heading into his 7th year of incarceration. So Bob Ginsburg is continuing to work on Abdul Zahir's case, but last July, something strange began to happen. His wife told him that the home phone, a regular landline, was behaving in an odd way.
Phone started buzzing, and then she didn't get a dial tone. Nobody could call in, and nobody could call out. So my wife went to a friend's house and called the phone company and asked them to come and repair the phone. They didn't come very quickly. So the following day, she was downtown, and she got a phone at the library, and she called again and said, please come and fix the phone. Well, this went on for 4 or 5 days. And the phone wasn't fixed until finally a Verizon employee got the phone service restored. But my wife was so irritated at the poor service that she filed a complaint with the Public Service Department, which is the agency in Vermont that regulates the phone company. So the phone is working again. And about a week later, we sit down having dinner. My wife says to me, boy, the funniest thing happened today. In the middle of the afternoon, the phone rang. I picked up the phone. I said, hello. Nobody answered, but I could hear you talking on the phone to somebody else. My wife said that it sounded like you were on your cell phone because it had that distant, echoey sound like you were on the water.
Yeah.
She said, I heard you talking to this other man, and I heard you say, and I talked to the lawyer on the other side, and then I heard the other man respond to you. So my wife said to me, she said, I just assumed that somehow you were on your car phone, your cell phone, and you were talking to him, and somehow or other you managed to make the phone dial the house. And the phone rang, and I picked it up, and I heard all this. So I did have that conversation. That was an exact quote of what I said. I was talking to a client in Massachusetts, but I was in my office. I wasn't on my car phone. And my office phone is a landline, just like the phone at home.
Your office is not in the home, is it?
My office is 15 miles away from my home.
So your wife hears the phone ring at home. She picks it up, and she's listening in on you on your office phone having a conversation with someone in Massachusetts.
That's exactly right.
Okay. What do we do next?
Well, I just said to her, phone's tapped. That was my immediate reaction.
Yeah, mine too.
And because I considered it very serious, among other things, I was very concerned because I'm a lawyer and maybe somebody else is listening in on privileged communications that I'm having with my clients. So I went to a fellow lawyer who's familiar with an out-of-town detective firm, and he ran the problem by them. Their response was immediate. They said the phone is tapped. They even had a name for it. It's called the split-resplit tap. And they said that somewhere a physical connection is being made between the office line and my home phone, and those calls are being monitored from that point. And earlier I mentioned to you about the problem my wife had with the phone at home the week before, 2 weeks before this happened.
When it went dead, yeah.
And right around this time, my wife got a response from the Public Service Department, which included a report that they had required Verizon to provide them with. And this report says that a work order was issued, the technician went out, and the technician found that two parts of the wire were transposed at some point along the line.
So Verizon had checked into the line on the basis of your earlier complaint.
And
they'd in fact come up with the same conclusion that somebody's wired into your phone.
Says that two, I'm reading from it. I brought it with me. Says that two parts of the wire were transposed at some point along the line. So the lawyer who was helping me, his name David Slay, David wrote to Verizon and asked them for a more detailed report on what went wrong with my phone. And he got back a report that wasn't the same as what I just read to you in this work order report that Verizon gave to the Public Service Department.
Verizon gave him a different report that didn't have any mention of this wiring.
Yeah,
right?
That some wires had broken at a point where a main telephone wire crosses some river, and that new wires had been strung in place of that.
This is not going to connect your office phone 15 miles away with your home phone, though, is it?
You wouldn't think so. I didn't think so. So finally, David wrote again to Verizon, and they finally responded to him saying that, I'm reading again, it is the policy of Verizon New England not to disclose whether any governmental agency has requested records of a customer's account with Verizon or sought to monitor, record, or intercept calls on the customer's line. And that was the end of David's correspondence with Verizon.
Okay, so this is a stupid question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Did you think about calling Homeland Security or the FBI and saying, hi, my name is Bob Ginsburg, I'm a lawyer, and it looks like someone's tapping my phone. Would you guys care to investigate this?
I did, and I smiled, and I did not make the phone call.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. To be clear, our guest says he isn't looking to pin all his phone glitches on wiretaps, but he says this seems like more than just coincidence.
Every now and then, my phone turns itself on and dials a client. Sometimes when I'm not in the office, my secretary can hear it happen when she's out at her desk. The phone will just turn itself on and dial a client. So
this is like a bad science fiction movie.
Well, it is kind of, and I've experienced it too. There's a writer for Harper's Magazine writing an article on privacy. And because of the news that surrounded this wiretapping that I experienced, he asked if he could interview me. So I told him that it was fine. And he came down to the office and he was interviewing me about what you and I are talking about right now. Just as his interview was coming to an end, my phone turned itself on and dialed the client while he was sitting there. It's almost like I had arranged it, which of course I hadn't, because I didn't know how to do that. He was just astonished because he could see that there was something obviously peculiar going on with my telephone system.
How about your computer?
That's a little less certain because any sophisticated person who knows how to do it can hack into a computer. Mm-hmm. But I have had problems with my computer, and those problems have always related to that part of my computer that has my Guantanamo case in it. I came in to work one day on the weekend. I sat down, turned on a computer, go to the desktop, and the folder with all of my Guantanamo work in it is gone off the desktop. It's not where it always was. And I went looking for it. I'm not that computer savvy. I went looking for it around the computer in other places that I knew of where it might be, thinking that I had inadvertently saved the whole thing, although I couldn't imagine I would do that, to a different place in the computer. But I was unable to find it. The following Monday, I spoke with people who advise us about our computer systems, and they told me where else to go looking for it. And sure enough, the whole folder was somewhere else in the computer in a place that I would say I never knew existed. I needed connect the dots instructions to be able to go find it, but I did find it, and it was intact. And I restored it to its normal place, and it happened again about two and a half weeks later. So when it happened the second time, then I began to suspect that this was not inadvertent, because it happened twice, and it happened twice with the same folder, and it happened to be my Guantanamo folder. So again, I went down to see Dave Slade, the lawyer who's helping me on this. We sent the computer, the whole computer, everything. We just sent it to a forensic computer firm, a bunch of computer detectors, and asked them to look at it. They did look at it and advised me that there was a, I guess you would call it a virus.
Something that shouldn't have been there.
The virus allows the computer to be controlled remotely, and that there had been massive downloads from the computer. He goes on to say that this virus or this infection was first discovered in 2005.
And 2005 was the year that you agreed to begin to represent
us. Yes, this was a common infection found back in 2005 and was spread by email with a screensaver as an attachment. But I've never had a screensaver on it. When we got that computer report, that's what precipitated a letter that I wrote to all of our clients saying that we know that our phone has been tapped, and we know that our computers have been invaded. We think the government may be behind it, but in any event, you need to know that your communications with me are not confidential. Somebody's listening in on them. Somebody is seeing them.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Bob Ginsberg says he got a uniformly encouraging response from his clients. In fact, he says the firm didn't lose any business over this. But what about his thoughts? What does he think of this apparent wiretap?
I became a lawyer because I learned in college how important the rule of law is to a decent society. I wanted to be a lawyer because I wanted to take part in that. And it's this breach of that most fundamental principle of our government that I find frightening.
The interesting thing is that you were telling me earlier that when you did meet with your client at Guantanamo Bay, Abdul Zahir, you talked to him about, you know, what the principles of justice are, the principles that are supposed to represent America both at home and abroad. I just wonder how your own feeling about those principles has changed.
My feeling about those principles remains the same. I still believe in that. That may be somewhat naive now. The reason I wanted to do this case and represent this prisoner in Guantanamo was I wanted to fight back for the rule of principles and for the rule of law.
Bob, just one more question. Do you ever ask yourself if you're doing this Abdul Zahir guy a favor by continuing to represent him? If, in fact, your phones are tapped, if, in fact, your computer is being checked, do you ask yourself if you're really doing any good for this guy?
Regularly. So I do ask myself from time to time whether what I'm doing is doing him any personal good or not. I think the answer is yes. It gives him some hope, gives him some courage. He does trust us now. And maybe eventually, if we have a hearing in court, I'll be able to establish that he's not an enemy combatant and that he should not be detained in Guantanamo. So I feel very comfortable that I'm trying to help the client and am helping him. Yes.
Does he know that your phone might be tapped?
No. No, I don't think so. I haven't had that discussion with him, nor in any correspondence I've had with him by mail.
Would you tell him?
Yeah, I probably would, yes.
Bob Ginsberg is a lawyer in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Thanks today to Gregory Clayton. He is a listener and a fellow lawyer in Littleton, New Hampshire. Gregory alerted us to Bob's story. And he gives me an opportunity to invite you to do the same thing. If you know of a story that needs telling, get in touch with me. Send me a short note to our website at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.